From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome to the China in the World podcast. I'm delighted this morning to have with me Dr. Michael Swain joining the China in the World podcast. He is in Beijing this week as part of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's Distinguished Speakers Program. I'm sure many of our listeners are already familiar with Michael and his work, but let me quickly introduce him. He's a senior fellow in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I've been with the Carnegie Endowment for close to two decades now. He is really one of America's most prominent analysts on U.S.-China, and in particular, Chinese security studies. Before Carnegie, Michael spent over a decade as a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. He was the inaugural holder of the RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy Chair in Northeast Asian Security. He's got a Ph.D. from Harvard University, spent time at Berkeley as a postdoctoral fellow, prolific writer. And it was one of the lead authors this summer in the widely read open letter on China that was published in the Washington Post in July of 2019. The letter entitled "China is Not an Enemy." Michael, thank you for joining the China in the World podcast.
Great, thank you, Paul, for asking me.
Michael, I want to open. We have seen a real shift in the way that this administration, President Trump, is approaching China. A much more hardline position on China emanating from senior officials in Washington. There was the National Security Strategy that was published in 2017, the National Defense Strategy in early 2018. These documents called China a revisionist power, a strategic competitor, really laid out a case that China is increasingly becoming a rival. How do you see this shift? Where did this come from, and what is the Trump administration aiming to do here?
Well, thanks for that question. I think that this shift came from a evolution, viewing the evolution of certain policies and actions that were undertaken by the Chinese, and actually began before the Xi Jinping period. It probably began during the Hu Jintao era, which showed more assertive China, a China that was acting more proactively in defending its interests beyond its own borders, having a much greater degree of influence and presence in the Western Pacific, and acquiring capabilities in the military area, which had direct consequences and implications for the U.S. position in the region. And then also was, under Xi Jinping, becoming more assertive in expanding Chinese economic activities around the world with the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a very ambitious effort to try to have more and more Chinese investment in countries all the way from Asia to Europe. And the undertaking of certain more assertive actions in the South China Sea over contentious maritime issues. And then combined with that, the turn within China towards a more controlling, party-directed, ideologically to some degree oriented line about where China needs to go and what China needs to do in order to preserve its independence and to strengthen itself against what the Chinese saw as a challenge from the West to try to contain or limit China's development. Because as China was becoming more successful and more capable, the United States, in the Chinese view, would become more oriented towards trying to contain China. So I think the West sort of looked at all this and the turn towards this more ideological, more party-driven, more assertive, and more capable China, and started to question whether or not, in fact, the original goals of engagement in bringing China into the international order and having it become more open and more liberal in its political values and its outlooks, whether or not that has really had any real effect on China.
So I notice you use the word the West, which implies not just the U.S., but other countries in the Western world, other developed countries. We also heard this summer during our track U.S.-China Track 2 in Washington, D.C., when engaging with Trump officials, their view that this is actually, this approach that the Trump administration is taking is an extension of the frustrations that built during the Obama administration in particular, but even before that, around issues like the South China Sea and the island buildup, around the huge amount of cyber theft of corporate intellectual property, around an inability to really address in an effective way these economic and trade issues that have been on the agenda for such a long time, that these Trump officials were saying, look, this is not anything new that we're bringing to the table. This comes out of a frustration that extends out. That would imply, of course, that even if Hillary Clinton would have won, we would have seen a major shift. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it depends on degree. It depends on exactly what issues you're talking about. But I think that regardless of the Trump administration succeeding or not, even under a Hillary Clinton administration, you would have seen a more, what's the right word, kind of more confrontational, more competitive, more hardline approach to interpreting China. The question really is, what is the best policy to pursue in order to address some of these significant grievances and problems that the United States and other Western countries and other countries in general have had with China's development model, with China's economic and military presence and policies in Asia and elsewhere? Would there be a more moderate, a more realistic, more balanced approach to dealing with these issues? And my criticism of the Trump administration is that it has been, in some ways, just too simplistic in its assessment about China. It has not accurately grasped the greater complexities of China. And by that, I mean the fact that China is not just one monolithic entity that is now locked under the control of the Chinese Communist Party, and that that party is all unified in support of a set of values that is reflected in Xi Jinping's speeches, as if nothing has changed in China. In effect, China has reverted at lock, stock, and barrel to the sort of pre-Deng era or the Mao era in some sense. I think that's a huge distortion of where China is today. I think there's much more complexity and viewpoint within China, including within the party, about where it needs to go in the future. And I don't think that is getting at all reflected in the way the United States characterizes China, which is, as you just described, in the national security strategy, national defense strategy, a very clean, in some sense, simplistic and extreme interpretation of what China is, what the potentials are for China, etc.
The narratives coming out of the U.S. about China, as you imply, are becoming extremely antagonistic and really hardened. China is an economic competitor or economic predator. China is a security and military rival. China is an ideological threat now, you hear. Vice President Pence has now given a couple seminal speeches on China that lays out a litany of grievances on China. You're suggesting that even if a Democratic president, Hillary Clinton, had come forward, much of the same set of issues would be on the agenda with China. The list of grievances that Pence put forward, do you generally agree with those issues? Or are you concerned that in many cases they're being exaggerated? Is that what I hear you say?
Yeah. I mean, I by no means would endorse the kind of characterization that the Pence speeches and speeches by Pompeo, the original speech by Rex Tillerson on the free and open Indo-Pacific. I think all of these, again, presented a sort of cartoonish image of what China is about. And it was a concern about that image, that one-dimensional kind of zero-sum approach to dealing with China and what China is, that really led to the development of that open letter that you mentioned that appeared in July of last year, where there were a lot of sinologists and non-China expert individuals in foreign policy and other areas that were not, they were very troubled by the very extreme and one-dimensional line that the Trump administration had taken in trying to characterize what the challenge is that China presents to the United States. And so in that letter, we sought to sort of explain what we thought was a more balanced, a more realistic reflection of the reality of China today and its implications for the United States.
What, in your view, just stepping back a little bit and looking at the Trump administration and dealing with China, because what I hear you saying is there are some legitimate concerns that when it comes to China. So in your view, of the things the Trump administration has put forward, what are the legitimate issues that we should be most worried about and we should be dealing with in a more aggressive way, perhaps, than we have in the past?
Well, I think there are several. I mean, one issue you mentioned yourself, which is the whole question of technology theft and cyber espionage in the commercial area. I think that China has been a major participant in those efforts. I mean, they're not unique by any means. Other countries do this. But the United States has been particularly concerned of the size and the scope and the scale, the intrusiveness of Chinese cyber attacks in areas that really do relate to commercial competitiveness. And they're not simply national security related issues. Although that is, of course, a very unclear line. Some people would make the argument that, in fact, many of the companies that we regard as private entities that are part of the defense establishment, the Raytheons and the McDonnell Douglases and others, are really national security related entities. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese are quite justified in going after them in cyber espionage the way we go after national security related cyber goals. But that's a very hard issue to be able to resolve any very clearly, because very little people know exactly what is going on. And they particularly don't know what's going on the U.S. side. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of stuff is written about what the Chinese are doing. Not a whole lot's written about what the United States is doing. But that said, I think it probably is the case that the Chinese have engaged in more commercially oriented cyber espionage than they should be doing. And they've also put pressure on Western companies in technology transfer. And they've also been giving preferential treatment to Chinese companies in ways that people think are excessive or unfair. So I think those are all areas that deserve some real attention. Another area that's really important has to do with the way in which the Chinese approach these economic development concepts like the Belt and Road and other things. The Chinese are not as transparent as they need to be in talking about what the motives are and the modalities are and methods of the Belt and Road. I think they need to be more receptive to foreign participation. They say they are, but it hasn't really taken off that much. And that's in part perhaps Western hesitancy or hesitancy of outsiders about how profitable some of these ventures might be. But nonetheless, I think the Chinese should be more transparent and they should be adopting more international standards in that kind of an area, as they did with the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. They should be doing the same thing there.
And what about in the economic and security and military realm, your area of expertise?
Yeah, well, and that's, I was going to say, in that security area, the genuine concern is the implications for stability and order in the Western Pacific in particular. That's the real issue of China's continued growth and development of its military capabilities. It's, in effect, its power projection capabilities. Because over the last 15 to 20 years, the Chinese have progressively and systematically put in place a range of capabilities that clearly call into question the ability of the United States to be able to operate with freedom along the Western Pacific, along the Chinese periphery, per se. Now, you can argue, and I argue, that Chinese have every legitimate right to strengthen their national security capabilities, to reduce their vulnerability, if you will, to possible U.S. threats or U.S. attacks. However unlikely we in the West might think they might be, the Chinese nonetheless have a perfect right to be able to strengthen their capability. And that's where the source of a real problem is. The United States has long operated in the Western Pacific on the basis of the assumption that what best serves stability and prosperity in Asia is American military predominance. And of course, America's economic imprint and its political influence. But the military predominance equation is now changing. Yeah. And the Chinese are really acquiring greater capabilities to call into question that American assumption. And the question is, how do you arrive at, and I think this is a legitimate question the Trump administration and others ask, how do you arrive at a meaningful understanding about what the military balance should be in Asia?
So you've raised, you know, cyber issues, economic and business concerns, concerns related to the Belt and Road, and of course the security dimension in the Asia Pacific. I follow you on social media. You're very outspoken on issues related to human rights and values. You've been talking in social media quite a bit about your concerns about what's happening in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. Do you see those issues as center in the U.S.-China relationship?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I think that these issues have a major impact not just on how governments look at China, but how populations, how people look at China. And that is a major, major factor here, because in the United States, I think the American public doesn't have the kind of more sort of zero-sum alarmist view about China and what it means for the United States than we see in Washington, and that many Americans are not as committed to the idea of, in effect, taking on the Chinese as some in Washington seem to be. And I think that reflects a certain hesitancy about the extent of the threat that China poses and what we need to do about it. Most Americans, when polled, say that they prefer to have a positive, favorable relationship with China, even though they are increasingly concerned about Chinese behavior. Mm-hmm. Now, the human rights violations that are so egregious and so serious and have such an impact in the West, I think that that undermines any kind of confidence that Americans and others have in being able to work effectively with China in a variety of areas, including, in, of course, in human rights. So I tell the Chinese all the time, and I mean, they try to defend this behavior in Xinjiang because of the nature of the attacks that ethnic terrorists, Islamic fundamentalists have carried out against the Chinese, against Han Chinese. Therefore, it's required that we have to put 1 million people in these internment camps. And I just don't accept that argument at all.
So it's interesting, Michael, because, you know, you've laid out a series of legitimate concerns that the whoever is in power in the United States, whether it's Republican or Democrat, will have to deal with regard to China. The open letter you mentioned that came out, a lot of people tended to characterize it as pro-China. Mm-hmm. But that's not what I hear you saying.
Yeah.
What I hear you saying are there are legitimate concerns that the United States, the Trump administration should have, but it sounds like you're suggesting a more realistic, thoughtful assessment of where the challenges are with regard to China that can then be part of or tied to an effective strategy. What was the goal of the open letter? Why have some characterized it as a pro-China letter?
Well, I think, first, the goal of the open letter was simply to indicate that among thinking American experts, foreign policy people, not just China experts, there, in fact, is no clear consensus behind what China is today and what we need to do about it, of the kind of consensus that you seem to think is that seems to be expressed in the American documents, the National mm-hmm. Security Strategy, mm-hmm. National Defense Strategy. There are a lot of people who don't agree with the extremist view that is expressed in those documents. So I think the very existence of the open letter and the number of people who have signed it, which is now nearly 200 influential people in the foreign policy community in Washington, and also some in the business, some in the military area, I think that alone reflects the fact that there is no clear consensus in Washington to be endorsing the kind of more extreme view that the Trump administration has adopted towards China. As far as its impact is concerned, I think that's, you know, really difficult to measure. I think it certainly in conversations that I have had with various people, there are people outside of China and outside of the United States who have looked very favorably on this letter, who are parts of foreign governments who think that there needs to be a more balanced approach to dealing with China. I don't think people took it necessarily as being pro-China per se.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is that the letter was really intended to address the deficiencies in the extreme nature of aspects of U.S. policy,
yeah,
without for a minute endorsing or accepting or condoning a lot of the bad behavior,
yep,
that is motivating policy in the West to deal with China in some of these areas. But people nonetheless thought that it should have been a more evenly balanced paper that really spoke about U.S. shortcomings and Chinese shortcomings. But as I say, again, the real concern was that the United States had been pushing so far in an extreme direction that there needed to be some statement made about that fact.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I don't see it as a pro-China letter at all. I think in the current domestic political context that the U.S.-China debate is playing out in,
right,
it's, you know, it's very convenient to call it a pro-China letter because then people won't pay
attention
to it,
right,
and people then discredit it. And,
right,
and my point really through this podcast is to point out how it is not, in fact, that it is that you do raise in the letter legitimate concerns, but you're advocating for a more thoughtful, measured approach, in fact, a more effective approach in,
right,
dealing with these issues,
right,
and perhaps some diplomacy as well, which we seem to have moved away from. Mm. Now, I want to get back to some of the speeches. I mentioned Vice President Pence's speech. He gave a speech in 2018. He gave a speech also at the end of 2019. And you've talked this week about some of the differences that you've seen in the rhetoric. And I wanted to, you know, for our listeners, whether you can talk a little more about that.
Sure. Yeah, I think we have seen elements of official U.S. speeches in recent months that have really modified or qualified the kind of more extreme rhetoric and characterizations of China that we saw in the National Defense Strategy, Security Strategy, and some speeches made by Pompeo and Pence and Tillerson. And it's been modified in the sense that there hasn't been a sort of rejection of the idea that China is a revisionist power and that it poses a lot of fundamental threats to the United States in a variety of different areas, which are in those documents. But it says that all being the case, notwithstanding, the United States does not want to contain China. The United States does not want China to fail. The United States does not want to decouple from China. The United States recognizes the need to engage China. It needs to have areas where it can strengthen cooperation with China. I mean, when these elements came out, which were in the more recent Pence speech.
This was in October 2019.
Right. And so there was also a certain amount of this same element in a Pompeo speech that was made around the same time. And there was also elements of this in remarks made by a senior Defense Department official at the Xiangshan Forum here in Beijing not long ago. And so it really was kind of puzzling. I mean, it was puzzling to me and some other people because that kind of theme, that kind of narrative did not seem to be very compatible with the more extreme zero-sum kind of characterization that existed prior to this. So the question really is, what's going on here? Some people think that it's really just rhetoric and that there's just an effort to try and mollify some people who have been a little too critical of the Trump administration, but that nothing really has changed. The Trump administration still is in favor of basically, in many ways, containing or limiting Chinese power in very fundamental ways, and perhaps even putting pressure on the Chinese government itself, et cetera, et cetera. I think that there may well be more to it than that, though. I think that this could very well reflect the fact that there are many countries around the world today, in Europe, in Asia, that are not very comfortable with the more extreme view that the United States has set out in these national security documents, that they are not in line with the U.S. effort to try and become more confrontational, more containment-oriented with the Chinese. I think we see that in the behavior of Japan, which is tacking in the direction of improved relations with China. I think we see that in the context of the ASEAN countries, where at the recent Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore, the Singaporean prime minister spoke out and said China needs to be given some level of breathing room or some level of maneuverability, as it were. And I think that reflected a broader ASEAN view that they, even though they wanted the United States to be dealing with China and confronting China on some of the areas that concerned them most, like maritime territorial disputes and things like that, they also were very concerned about where exactly the United States was going. Mm-hmm. What is the objective with China ultimately? Mm-hmm. I mean, does it want to undermine the Chinese government? Does it want to really contain China or not? Because the rhetoric certainly sounded as if that was the implication one would draw from all of those earlier statements. And I think the Europeans themselves have expressed some real misgivings mm-hmm. with some of the more extreme aspects of the U.S. approach. And we've seen the United States not succeeding in its effort to get the Europeans, for example, to stop dealing with Huawei mm-hmm. and to reject the Huawei-based 5G system. Yep. The Europeans are simply not going to do that.
Well, it's interesting because back to the theme of the open letter, what I hear you saying is that the international community, you've mentioned Japan, ASEAN countries, Europe, EU, also have a growing a set of concerns with regard to China. You see it in some of the documents the EU, for example, has put out in terms of the strategic outlook on China mm-hmm. last spring, where it called China an economic competitor and a systemic rival in mm-hmm. terms of proposing alternative forms of governance. You see concerns in Australia. Of course, they were the first country to ban 5G.
Right.
It was not the United States. And so, but these countries are not taking the extreme positions and the exaggerated positions that we have seen coming out of the Trump administration.
Right.
They seem to be making adjustments to policies and approaches to China to try to defend from China undermining its own interests.
Right.
But at the same time, they're trying to maintain a balanced approach where they can cooperate with China, where it's in their own interest to do so.
Right.
A less set of self-defeating policies. It's interesting that you suggest that perhaps the Trump administration is recognizing some of this, where they're not able to get traction in some of the more extreme approaches that they've used. Mm-hmm. Time will tell. They may just frankly be getting better at reassuring rhetoric now that they're three plus years into the administration.
Yes, that's possible.
Michael, I want to commend you for your work on the open letter. Also want to commend you on your tremendous work at Carnegie, especially in the area of security. Your report in 2016, Creating a Stable Asia, an Agenda for U.S.-China Balance of Power, where you discuss the structural and potentially destabilizing shift in the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific, was an excellent document. The analysis, I think, is some of the best I've seen. I want to encourage our listeners to read that, and we'll post that as well as when we post this podcast. But thank you for joining the podcast. And 2020 is going to be an interesting year in U.S.-China relations. We have, and maybe my final question will be around this, what can we expect? We've got potentially a Phase 1 deal coming up next week. We have an election in Taiwan, which will prove, I'm sure, to be somewhat difficult between the U.S. and China. We've got an election at the end of this year in the United States of America. As you look out over the next year, how do you see U.S.-China relations developing? What's your sense?
Well, my sense is that I don't think things are going to get any appreciably better.
Yeah.
Over the coming year. I think a lot of the themes that are expressed in Washington today are shared on both sides of the aisle. And there are a lot of people on the Hill who have as extreme a position, if not more so, than the Trump administration on dealing with China. A lot of these things are driven by the combination of what is seen in China as increased domestic repression, China's activities in the South China Sea, and the economic dispute that we have with the Chinese. And in all three of those areas, I don't think there's much variation in trying to look at the problems among different groups. The U.S. Democratic candidates haven't really been very specific, however, in talking about an overarching China strategy, an overarching China policy. They basically just had an individual kind of statements about trade issues, about not relying too heavily on a very blunt instrument like tariffs, but they haven't really challenged in any basic way the underlying assumptions about what China is and where it's going. I think that could change depending on who's elected. I think there are some indications that some of the candidates have a more reflective, a more balanced understanding about China and the need to be able to develop areas and sustain areas of cooperation with the Chinese. I mean, the big difference between the Democrats and Republicans on climate change and recognizing the importance of that and the threat that poses to all countries and the essential importance to work with the Chinese in that area. So there's some reason for hope in terms of having a more effective relationship with the Chinese over time, but it's going to take time. And I think the Chinese themselves have to step up more. They have to become more open and transparent in what they do, and they have to be more supportive of certain areas in technology and in other areas where they can become more reassuring, frankly, with other countries about where their objectives lie.
And under a Democratic president, would you see potentially a move back towards a more robust use of diplomacy and potentially working with our partners and allies around the world where we share concerns?
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. But I think that is another very strong potential, that the Democratic candidate, is going to put a greater emphasis on diplomacy. I mean, that has already been pretty clear that that's part of the criticism of the Trump administration. It just doesn't rely on, the Trump administration calls it deal-making, but it's not really diplomacy. And the reliance on all kinds of actions, most recently now the assassination of Soleimani in the Middle East, I think many people in the Democratic Party believe that is extremely counterproductive for U.S. interests. So that's going to play into an issue of wanting to uphold the rule of law more, international law, in a Democratic administration. So I think there are a lot of areas where you could see, I think, a more balanced and improved policy towards China, even though China will still be regarded as, in many ways, a competitor, a strategic competitor.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your perspectives, and I hope we can convince you to come back on the podcast and share your views in the future. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.